Okay, Daniel chapter 7. Well, we've been discussing Daniel, and we did Daniel chapter 5, chapters 5 and 6 last week, we discussed. And in chapter 5, we see that Belshazzar is the king of Babylon. And at the end, the Persians took the kingdom, which sets that date at 539 BC, the dating for the end of that chapter. In Daniel 6, it's Darius. The king, the Persian king, is called Darius, and Darius is really only a title. It has to refer to Cyrus the Great, but Darius is a title which had something to do with meaning lord or ruler or something like that in Persian. So they decided to use title for Cyrus rather than say Cyrus. So in chapter 6, Darius is ruling the kingdom. And we completed chapter 6, and now we're in chapter 7, and Belshazzar is ruling the kingdom again. And not only is Belshazzar ruling the kingdom, but it's the first year of Belshazzar, where Daniel chapter 5 is clearly the last year, in the last year of Belshazzar, the end of his rule, because at the end of that chapter, the Persians took the kingdom. So it's clear to me, since in Daniel chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar was still king, and Belshazzar ruled Babylon with his father for 16 years, it's clear to me that Daniel chapters 7 and 8 should have been placed, they belong, because chapter 8 is the third year of Belshazzar. Those two chapters belong before chapter 5 and after chapter 4. So Daniel chapter 7 should be Daniel chapter 5, and Daniel chapter 8 should be Daniel chapter 6, and then we should have Daniel chapters 5 and 6, and these chapters would be in the correct historical sequence. To be, nobody knows. It also follows this misplacement of chapters in the Septuagint, so it must have come to be at a very early time. But Jeremiah and Ezekiel also suffer likewise in some chapters. So that's all I have to say, is to make that clear in our listeners' minds and in our minds here, that these two chapters, their events, should actually be before Daniel chapter 5. Martin.
Daniel 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of it in his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and then it lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth, devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns, plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and the mouth speaking great things. I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. End of verse 10.
We probably shouldn't want to interpret this vision until Daniel himself gives the interpretation of it. It would be the prudent thing to do. We'll see that. I'd rather not comment much until we get to that point. For real.
Okay, I'll continue on. Verse 11. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. And concerning the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit, in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are 4, are 4 kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever, forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. And the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus, he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth. and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until time and times and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. End of chapter 7.
There's quite a few things I should say. It'll probably take me a moment. Starting with, I'm going to ignore the first 8 verses for now. Starting with Daniel chapter 7, verse 9. I beheld until thrones were cast down. That's the fall of Babylon. And the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. That's the final judgment described by Christ. It's described in the Gospel. It's described in the Revelation. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, I beheld even until the beast was slain and his body was destroyed and given to the burning flame. That's symbolic of the lake of fire in Revelation chapters 19 and 20. But this isn't happening yet. At this time. And as concerning the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away. Their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So that seems to me that these beasts are going to be done away with at some point, but they're still going to season and a time. So I think Daniel is compounding a wide range of future events in just one vision, in just a few verses, because all of this has been an ongoing process ever since the fall of Rome. I'll just move on with that for a moment. As concerning the rest of, verse 13, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came into the Ancient of Days, and they brought him here before him, and it was given him a kingdom, dominion, and glory, and all people will worship him. And that's the end of the vision. And now the vision's going to be interpreted. So I'm going to move on to that. These great beasts, which are 4 or 4 kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. So here we have basically a parallel with Daniel chapter 2, where Nebuchadnezzar was the first of 4 great kings, the head of gold, and then the 2 arms represent the Greek Empire, and the Medes and the Persians, and the body of brass represents the Greek Empire, and the 2 legs represent the Roman Empire in this great vision seen by Nebuchadnezzar. 4 empires. And then in chapter 2, after the destruction of that 4th empire, the saints of the Most High would take the kingdom. And not only that, but they would be instrumental in destroying that empire. So ever since the fall of Rome, the Germanic peoples have the Celtic slash Germanic peoples have dominated world history. That there are Slavic tribes or Eastern European tribes that had their heyday, but didn't rise to the same level of world domination that the Germanic tribes did in Western Europe. It's just the way it is. So it's the lines of where Israel are drawn are complex because of dispersions, but it's evident that the Anglo-German people are the core of that because they've dominated history ever since then. With the moments which the French and the Dutch and the Spanish had, right? I mean, and the Italians, they all had their moments in history. So the saints of the Most High did possess the king, do still possess the kingdom forever and ever, because they're not visibly ruled over by another beast, except for the eighth beast, which is of the seven in the Revelation, which isn't an empire of its own, so to speak. Rather, it sits on all the former world empires. That's a complex topic that's outside of the scope of this particular vision in this chapter. Daniel goes back. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others. And it was the same thing in Daniel chapter 2, where the fourth beast was diverse from all the others and had been much more dreadful and powerful than all the empires before it. The Roman Empire was much more dreadful and powerful than the Greek Empire, the Persian Empire, the Babylonian Empire that came before it. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Okay, there's two ways to interpret this. Rome was to break, the 10 toes were to break apart because the iron and the clay could not cleave to one another in Daniel chapter 2. And it might be interpreted that this 10th horn, well, these 10 horns are equivalent to those 10 toes, but this 11th that came up doesn't really fit into that scenario where there were only 10 senatorial provinces in the Roman Empire, and the rest of the provinces were provinces of conquest. They were imperial provinces belonging to the emperor. So those 10 toes should generally be interpreted as being those 10 senatorial provinces that couldn't cleave to one another because they consisted of both iron and clay. Justinian was a Roman emperor who fulfilled these prophecies here in Daniel that he'll say about this 10th horn more than anyone else had fulfilled them, and I'll get into that in a few moments. Justinian was the 11th emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire. When Rome divided in half, Justinian was the 11th empire. So are those emperors the 10 horns? That seems to be the case. There's other uses of 10 horns that would contradict that, or it seemingly contradict that. But the 10 horns out of this kingdom in verse 24, kings that shall arise. And then another shall arise after them, meaning any left, and he shall be diverse in the first, and he shall subdue three kings. Okay. So the saints of the Most High, Rome falls west, And the saints of the Most High, meaning the Germanic tribes, they are the stone cut out of the mountain without hands in Daniel chapter 2. So those Germanic tribes take the kingdom. They occupied all of the former Roman territory in the West, but not territory of the Byzantine Romans or the Greeks in the East. So they take over the entire Western Empire. Every Germanic tribe gets a piece of it. And these 10 horns are 10 kings. And this 11th horn is a king which arises after them, whose look was more stout than his fellows and had a mouth speaking very great things, and before whom three fell. When Justinian became the emperor, the 11th king of the Eastern Empire, he regained for the empire three of the provinces which had the saints of the Most High had taken from the Romans. He regained part of Spanish Gaul. I don't remember the name of the kingdom or the king that he had conquered there, and I'll probably try to look it up before I finish this talk. He also conquered Cotilla and Vitiges. And he also conquered, I think his name was Gelimer, the king of the Vandals in Africa. So he retook Italy, what we know today as Spain, and the Gothic king Agila he defeated in Spain, and Gelimer, the Vandal king of Africa. Those Germanic tribes had taken those Roman provinces for themselves, and Justinian, which is perfectly in line with his prophecy, him being the 11th king of the Eastern Byzantine Empire, he had taken those three kings and conquered them and took those provinces back for the empire, even though that was temporary. And in Spain, it was very temporary. It lasted about 70 years. So this prophecy, Justinian instituted a new legal code that ultimately became the legal code for all of Europe, even the parts of Europe he never ruled over. Justinian also changed the calendars. Or he also instituted the temporal authority of the Pope in his legal code. It was encoded in his legal code that the Pope would be the head of all the churches in Christendom, and those popes changed the calendar. So Justinian, in that manner, fulfilled all of these prophecies of what this 11th horn was going to do. And of course, the popes, Justinian himself and the popes, had made war against the saints of the Most High throughout their entire time. Throughout the entire time that the popes had ruled Europe, and the popes ruled Europe because Justinian gave them that legal right to rule Europe in his legal code that all of Europe adopted. And that remained the European legal code in every European nation until the time of Napoleon, the Justinian Code. Doing this off the top of my head, I don't know if I missed anything I should speak that I should speak about. Y'all can point that out.
Yeah, I think you did real well, Bill. But question,
the papacy ruled over Christendom, even though Rome fell in 476 AD, the popes replaced the Roman Empire and ruled over Europe until the time of Napoleon. There are other prophecies which govern the circumstances of the ending of the papacy the eighth beast of Revelation, which is basically this international corporate banking system that rules over us all today. But, and they're outside of the scope of this prophecy, but this is the times and dividing over time, those three times that we saw earlier in Daniel, that's 1260 years, and that's exactly how long the popes had ruled over Europe, 1260 years from the time of Justinian to the time of Napoleon. Vindications here that the office of the papacy is this little horn of Daniel, starting with Justinian and ending with the last pope. I think it was Pope, I don't remember his name, I'm sorry. I almost said the wrong pope by accident. It was a pope that Napoleon arrested, and that ended the power of the papacy in Europe over the kings of Europe. The popes were that they had authority over all the kings of Europe, recognized the authority of the pope until Napoleon arrested the pope. And I believe that was in 1791 or 92. Maybe it was a little later. It was Pope Pius VII, I believe, that the Pope had arrested. I can't get a straight answer from Wikipedia, from Google. Imagine that. This should be cut out. 1608. French troops entered Rome and their commander deposed Pope Pius VI. So it was Napoleon that broke that power of the Pope over the kings of Europe. The popes were always playing politics and favoring one nation over another and getting nations to fight each other or instigating wars going on for centuries. These four kings, these four kingdoms, I want to discuss them a little bit. Four great beasts, they were all described as parts of a single beast in Daniel 2. Here, there are four great beasts. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld to the wings thereof were plucked and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to him, to it. And that seems to be Babylon itself. And it seems to reflect on the madness of Nebuchadnezzar. It seems to. And that's simply only from, I can't identify that any better except from the order in which these four beasts are described, because the second one, behold, another beast, a second like unto a bear, and it had raised itself up on one side, and it had three ribs in its mouth between the teeth of it. Well, those three ribs can be likened to former empires. If we understand that this is the Persian, the Media and Persia, and Media and Persia were united to each other by marriage in the time of Cyrus I, the king of Persia. So the Persians rose up and conquered all the other empires. Cyrus did that in the name of the Persians. So if you imagine the bear being Media and Persia, it raised itself up on one side and had three ribs in the mouth of it. Persia had conquered three great former empires, all their territory, all the territory of the empires, the former empires of the Egyptian, Assyrian, and Babylonian. So they seem to be the three ribs. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. the beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. And a leopard is very fast. And Alexander the Great had overthrown the Persians and conquered the entire Persian Empire in about 10 years, fast like a leopard. And then his empire was lost, according to another vision in Daniel chapter 11. His empire was lost to the four winds of heaven, and that would be these four wings, what these four wings represent here. A mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken. Alexander was assassinated after only 10 years of rule and shall be divided towards the four winds of heaven and not to his posterity. In other words, his son didn't inherit any part of his kingdom, and he didn't. Nor according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked, even for others besides those. So Alexander's four generals divided his empire into four pieces, four of his notable generals. And after that, they couldn't even all maintain those kingdoms. So Daniel, when you put these visions of kingdoms together, Daniel 11, Daniel 7, Daniel 2, It's they all coincide, and they all basically give the same account of the same kingdoms in different ways, in different language. But when you put them together and see that, it's even more clear that that is what Daniel's prophesying. So after this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terribly and strong exceedingly. And that's exactly how the fourth kingdom in Daniel chapter 2 is described, in very similar terms, as being much more powerful and fearsome than the others, much more terrible than the others. So that's about all I have to say, unless there's more that y'all want to talk about.
Was the fourth kingdom the kingdom of iron in Daniel chapter 2?
I'm sorry, yes. The feet of iron.
Oh, but in Daniel chapter 7, it's teeth of iron. All right. And so the saints take the kingdom forever and ever. But then there's that prophecy that they would hand over their kingdom to the beast. So does that come into play, Bill? Because it's not like they've lost the kingdom. They've actually handed it over to the beast. Is that?
Well, right. They've handed over the kingdom to the beast while they still hold it, because they've made themselves agents to the beast.
They become a whore riding on the beast.
Right. They still hold it, they still possess it, but they basically given it over to the beast voluntarily. The beast is not a military power that possesses it. They are the military power of the beast. They've become a whore, right?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because there's no way they could rule unless we allowed them to rule. Because I mean, they instigated war, brother wars, so that they could have power, isn't it? So, yeah, that makes sense to me.
We allow them to rule it. Every single one of us is responsible for it to some degree. I mean, these international banks and corporations rule over us. Most people don't even know that. They don't even see that.
It's like our sins allow them to.
Yes, and we all purchase things to those corporations. We all support them in one way or another.
Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you, Bill, on this chapter is, it says, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days. Isn't that verse used by, like, the Catholic Church to claim that the Trinity is in the Old Testament or something?
Yeah, I think this is one of those verses that they try to use, that they try to twist in order to support that.
But it's not the Son of Man in the text, is it? It's a Son of Man. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the Son of Man in verse 13 is Jesus, does it?
No, it's a Son of Man. There is no definite article in the text describing a Son of Man. It's a Son of Man. And that's the zealousness of the King James translators, I believe, because they were all Trinitarians. There's no definite article in Hebrew. That word the is not in Hebrew. So it's like a Son of Man.
So a Son of Man, could that be like a leader or like an angel coming before the Ancient of Days, which would be God? And so he's coming with the clouds of heaven, the armies of heaven, to God, brought near him near before. So it's not like the Catholic Church claims it's Jesus coming to Yahweh. This Son of Man could just be like an angel or a messenger coming before. How would you read that?
Yeah, you know, the way that this is ordered in this description, it could be a reference to Christ, to God coming as a man, and then ascending up to the Father, as Christ himself said.
Oh, okay, yeah, that point, yeah.
Of himself. But because of the way this is ordered, this could be a reference to Christ in the flesh. Which is possible from have to explain it that way. And that's a possibility. I mean, I would explore that at depth if I ever wrote commentary on this chapter. Which I've written commentaries on this chapter, but not a commentary for this chapter, right? Because the commentaries I've written are in certain contexts in order to explain certain things, but not everything in the chapter.
But even so, that doesn't support a Trinity just because you have Christ, yeah, because Christ and then the Ancient of Days, that doesn't mean they're different people. That means that one's the incarnation, the Son of Man, he's the fleshly nature.
Right. Different manifestations of the same God.
Yeah, because in the next verse, he's given dominion and glory and a kingdom.
So I think that might be missing something. You were talking about no definite article in Hebrew?
Right.
So what about the Baha?
Microphone. There's no Ha preceding Son of Man in the Hebrew of that passage.
Okay, got it.
I know what a definite article in Hebrew looks like. If you could see the Hebrew, it's not there. There's no Ha there.
Got it.
It's a single preposition that means like or as, that's affixed to the word ben for son, bar for son. And the next word is man, and there's no ha there. Like a Son of Man is exactly what it says. It's six letters total for like a Son of Man.
Hey, Bill.
Here because my Bible Works crashes every time I try to do that. What's up, Michael?
Hey, how are you? Hey, Bill, I got a question on this. Can we possibly allegorically say part of this might have been fulfilled in 70 AD or roundabouts? Verse 13 of 14?
No.
Even a little bit?
No.
Okay, well, you know, I love the seven. You know, I'm a 70 AD guy because it's simple and easy and it's clean and everything fits.
What do you mean a 70 AD guy? You're a preterist.
Well, I mean, I like Bill, please, just, I don't want you to get angry. I am kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, I like to voice what
so
I like.
You take instead of the scripture.
Well, there, I've studied, you know this, Bill, well enough. I've studied the different views. I mean, like, there's certain passages I put in 70 AD, like Romans 16:20.
I think we're really spending too much time in Popeyes.
No, in fact, I just left her. They got a special on their chicken broth noodles. Delicious.
I think they put LSD in it.
No, they don't. It's good. It's good.
So yeah, you think all prophecy was fulfilled in 70 AD?
I would lean more. What I look at is partial preterist and historicism. You got like Daniel 9. I look at that being fulfilled in 70 AD. Daniel 7, I've had questions on. That's why I asked Bill if we could, you know, play around a little
Michael,
bit.
There's tons of information. I mean, this has been gone over for like years and years and years. There's tons of information on it.
No, I understand that, Martin. I'm aware of all that. That's why I just asked Bill, because there is a lot of, even within CI, there's been debates on this.
Let's look at these four kingdoms. How long did they last? These four kingdoms that are clearly being described here.
Right.
Are the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, and the Roman. So how long did they last?
Well, I think the last part of the Roman Empire ended, what, 476, Bill?
Yeah, that's 406 years after 70 AD. Prophecy is still going on.
Okay. Yeah, I've taken that position for years. I have. And Bill, I got one other question on the latter.
Been wrong for years.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay, Bill, I got another question. In the last part of verse 13, it says, "And they brought him near before him." There's two hymns in here, and I'm not very good at reading sometimes because I'm getting up in years. Who was the first hymn, and who's the second hymn?
Which verse is this?
The last sentence, I got my New King James out because it's easier for me. "And they brought him," capital H-I-M, "near before him," capital H-I-M. Who were the two hymns here? The first one of this.
The Son of Man and the Ancient of Days.
Okay, so the Son of Man is one hymn, and then the second hymn is the Father.
The Ancient of Days, yeah.
Okay. Now, Bill, you were talking about whether it could be an angel, a messenger. Could this Son of Man being just a messenger other than Yeshua?
When you read 14, I should have said that, because when I read verse 14, it said, "And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all," so that has to be Christ, doesn't it?
Has to be Christ. Yep.
Okay, then the next question, these peoples and nations and languages, Bill, would these nations at the time of Paul and Christ, would have they been limited to the nations that came out of Abraham's loins through Isaac and Jacob? Or would it have been broader than that?
They're the ones that are going to inherit the earth.
He's not going to rule over mongrels because they shouldn't even exist under his law. So there's no way.
Michael, the Puerto Ricans, the Chinks, the Hottentots, they're not getting in.
No, I know that, Martin. That wasn't my question. My question was the contrasting at the time of
inherit the earth.
I know Abraham was, but my question, Bill, is
why would this prophecy be outside of that promise?
Well, the preterist, if you ask a preterist, they'll say that Christ is going to rule a king, because they'll say the kingdom's already come. And so then you ask them, well, why is Christ ruling over all these mongrels? And they'll be like, I don't know.
Yeah, Joe, I know better than that. Okay, trust me. Guys, follow me just for a second here. The reason I'm asking this is because Bill writes in his Galatians 3 paper, on Galatians chapter 3, Paul and Yeshua or Christ. The Adamic, Abraham, the seed of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob, those nations had, quote, subsumed all of the remnant of the Adamic nations at that time, and that Abraham at that time, there was at the time of Paul and Christ, Abraham had inherited the society, the white society.
Yeah, he did, but I didn't take I didn't say anything in reference to the sand niggers that moved in later.
No, I wasn't talking about that, Bill. I'm talking about the Genesis 10 nations. How much was left in the first century of what was left of the remnant of the Genesis 10 nations that didn't have, that did not have Isaac's son's blood in them, but were Adamic people outside of the those of Javan and those of Ionia?
There were some Persians left, and there were the Ionian Greeks, and there were Slavs in Eastern Europe.
Okay, but we're talking a very small amount at that time, right, in the first century.
Comparatively, yes.
Okay. All right, so these people and nations and stuff and languages would pretty much refer only to those at that in the first century and even up to today, only those of the white Saxon Israel nations.
Yeah, because it's only dealing with Abraham's seed.
Okay. Now, Bill, I got one other question.
It don't matter if Daniel understood that or not.
No, I understand. Yeah, see, some of the high, what I call the high-powered guys, you know, they'll take Daniel and say a lot of this was fulfilled during the intertestamental time. Have you ever heard of that before, Bill?
When is this fourth kingdom end?
Well, that's the thing. It crosses over from the old into the new during the time of Christ. I know that.
The fourth kingdom can't end until 476 AD.
Right.
And then this little horn comes.
Okay.
After that is the 10 horns and the 11th, which does all these other things for time and times and a half a time.
Yeah.
Would you say, Bill, that verse 14 was kind of fulfilled in 70 AD because Christ announced to his disciples that all authority has been given to me at that time?
Yeah, right. And then, so it was fulfilled in 33 AD.
I'm sorry. Silly thing to say,
but it had nothing to do with 70 AD.
Yeah, but it's an ongoing process, isn't it? Because he obviously we don't have our king with us, so we're waiting for it to be fully fulfilled.
Yeah, you know what? Here's the truth: Christ is king, and the only problem is that we haven't accepted that and followed Christ. When have whites ever followed Christ?
Very few in my lifetime.
Even all the Christian kings that have arisen haven't followed Christ. A few of them tried, but none of them really have.
So, Bill, what you're saying, majority of our white people in the last 2,000 years have not converted and repented and converted. They're basically bad sheep, even though they're sheep. Is that correct?
Well, I wouldn't call them bad sheep. They're just ignorant sheep, most of them.
Right, but a lot of them don't repent and convert. You know?
They've really been taught, right?
That's true.
Repentance means... putting $5 in the coin box and saying 10 Hail Marys and lighting a candle.
Yeah, or what they interpret born again, answering an altar call. So there's different methods out there that they use.
To them, that's repentance.
Yeah.
I know. I did. When I was a child, I was raised in Catholic Church. I did penance. I did the whole thing. I know what they do. I know what they think. They're full of shit, but I know what they do. You go say 10 Hail Marys, you light a candle, you put some money in the friggin' coin box, and you're forgiven your sins. Get the fuck out.
Yeah.
They don't even know what sin is, Bill. They don't define it. Like in 1 John 3, is it where sin is transgression of the law? So they don't even realize what sin is. If you said to them, if they were offended by you and they said, and you said to them, what was my sin? They would say, oh, you offended me, and you're not wearing a tie. And yeah. It's like, where's that in the law? Oh, sin is the law? I didn't know that, you know? So it's because, in my opinion, they don't realize that sin is transgression of the law. So they think they can get away with sins by feelings and saying sorry and all this. It's pretty retarded.
Hey, Joe, you just said something. I got a question that dovetailed to what you just asked. There's a verse in the Bible where Jesus said, woe unto them. Bill probably can help me with this. Woe unto them to whom the offenses come, or something like that. My question is the woe unto the guy bringing the offense, or is the woe unto the guy that gets offended?
Isn't that the verse where it says, offenses must come, but woe unto the man who the sin comes through? Is that the verse, Michael?
That's probably it, because I don't have my old KJV. I got my new KJV, and I can't find it. But my question was, in Jesus' statement, is the woe or judgment against the guy bringing the offense, or is the woe and judgment fall on the fools that get offended?
Woe unto the world because of scandalion, which is not necessarily a violation of the law. It's not transgression. It's a scandal, basically. Woe unto the world because of offenses. For it must be that scandalion or offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes.
Yeah, so it's the offender.
So it's the guy getting offended or his feelings hurt, basically.
The offender.
Or okay, but how do you interpret offender, Martin? That's my question. Is the offender the guy?
A person that causes a scandal is speaking of a person that's actually causing a scandal.
Okay. So those are the ones in that context.
It's like a really serious offense, right? Like. Problem is that word scandal doesn't appear very often in scripture. So let's do a search for that word. It appears in 36 verses. That includes at least three that are in the Apocrypha, four that are in the Apocrypha. New Testament, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 times. 13 times in the New Testament.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's that. This is probably the most pertinent verse that it appears in. It's Revelation chapter 2, verse 14. And where it says, "But I have a few things against you, because you had there some who hold the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel." Where it says put a stumbling block, right? It's the word cast or throw. A scandal of the sons of Israel before the sons of Israel. So it's somebody that causes you to make an offense. Right there in that Revelation chapter 2, verse 14. That scandal, it is somebody causing you to make an offense, that he's responsible for it.
I got that, Bill. So the contrast to that in Luke 2, after Luke 2:32, there's a passage, I'm trying to find it, where Jesus would be bring, he would fall and bring anger to the Judeans. Right? Contrast to that. Flip the other way around.
He became a cause of scandal to them. Why? Because he was who he said he was? It's their fault that they had that scandal.
Right, because they got pissed off at him.
Yeah.
So he was, what you're saying, Bill, and what I'm seeing in Luke 2, after Luke 2:32, which is one of my favorite verses. Blessed is Mary, mother, child, destined to be a fall and a rising of many in Israel, a sign which he spoken against. So Jesus was the sign, apparently. And they were getting offended and pissed off at him.
Yeah, but he didn't give them a cause to be pissed off.
Right, because everything he told them was true, and they got pissed off at him.
First John chapter 2. He that loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no occasion of stumbling in him. And that word occasion of stumbling is the same word, a scandal, a cause of stumbling.
Okay, but I guess my quick question was, Bill, didn't Jesus or Yeshua at the time of his earthly ministry cause, wasn't he a stumbling block to them where they got pissed off?
He was a stumbling block to his enemies, though.
That's what I mean, his enemies.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was purposeful.
Okay, that cleared. That was just bringing the contrast between it going one way in Revelation 2 and another way in Luke 2.
Well, it's just the context of the way the word is used. If you cause the enemies of God to fall and stumble, you're probably doing a good thing.
It's pretty much common sense, right?
So Peter used that same term, scandalon, in 1 Peter chapter 2, where he said a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. I mean, that was a planned scandal. I mean, that comes from the Psalms, right? That was a planned scandal planned by God.
I guess.
For the fall of his enemies.
No.
Does the word in Greek have a wider meaning than the word scandal does in English, Bill?
Yeah, it means to set a trap for somebody. To set a trap for an animal. It was used in hunting.
So there you go, Michael. It's not necessarily how we might think of scandal, because it's in the Greek word. It's an older word that has a wider range of meanings than what we use it today.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you bringing that up, Joe.
A scandale was the stick in a trap on which the bait is placed, and which, when touched by the animal, springs up and shuts the trap. And the animal's fucked.
So the enemies of Christ are like animals in a trap then.
Right. But if I make a trap for you to lure you into some sin, then I'm wrong, right?
There's also verses, Michael, that say something like, you know, the enemy will fall into his own devices.
Right. No, I follow all of that. In fact, I got a little commentary from years ago on this. It was just, I didn't know how to interpret where Jesus said, woe unto them to whom the offenses come. I didn't know how to interpret that. That's why I asked you guys that on that one passage.
If someone's not guilty of the offense, then why would they be in the wrong?
Well, that's true, Martin. I understand that, but I'm talking about the way it's worded in the passage. I understand that. But that particular passage, the way it was worded, I didn't know which direction the woe was going. You know, when Jesus was talking to, I forget who he was talking to. He might have been talking to his disciples, you know, giving him heads up on that. And I didn't know how to interpret that particular passage in that context. I couldn't find it, though.
Let's look at Galatians chapter 5, verse 11. And I'll read the King James Version. And I, brethren, if I yet preach circumcision. That should really say, if I still preach circumcision. Why do I yet suffer persecution? Then is the offense of the cross ceased. And that's an ideal, it's not an ideal translation, but it doesn't really do it any harm. That the that word offense is scandal, scandalon. The scandalon of the cross is what Paul was referring to, because the cross is designed to trip up the enemies of Christ.
Yeah, that's a tough verse to understand, Rick. I see it, Bill.
It was a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense.
When they killed Christ, they thought that they'd solved all their problems, but really, it was a trap, and now they're liable to the death penalty for deicide. So that's one angle, isn't it? So,
I'm trying to look for the relevant verse in the Psalms, and I can't find it. What do we have here? Psalm 118. No, that ain't it. Isaiah chapter 28. That ain't really what I'm looking for. I know it's somewhere in the Psalms. Well, I can't find it. Isaiah chapter 8. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread, and he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So those of Israel who don't accept them are going to stumble at that, but it's the inhabitants of Jerusalem who were meant to be trapped.
Right, and Bill, that term inhabitants, I was reading one of Bob Holstrom's little books years ago, and he pointed out the inhabitants, there's a lot of bad figs mixed with some of the good figs in that.
Yeah, I mean, that's explained tonight. Ezekiel and Jeremiah, and it's pretty clear in the New Testament.
Yeah. Bill, I don't want to get off topic. I got a quick question, and I'm going to put on my Balakias question cap here. Do you think that Sheila, who married the daughter of Shua, the Canaanite, was a Israelite?
Huh?
Do you think that Judah's wife that he married had a son named Shelah? Do you think that Shelah was an Israelite?
Not a true one. He was a bastard.
Okay.
His mom was a Canaanite.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Judah married the daughter of a strange god right there, Malachi 2:12. Come on.
I thought about that. And I mentioned that to Alan, and he said, no, you can't connect that. He thinks that she was a kid, that Shelah was a still an Israelite.
Right.
Well, he's then just being stupid and stubborn.
And how was she the daughter of a strange god? Like, does that just mean she's a different religion?
Because yeah, who else did Judah marry?
Because yeah, Israelites were called the sons and daughters of God as they were put off in captivity. They're gone. And Yahweh still calling them my sons and my daughters. You know, so the idea that she could be a daughter of a strange god, and that just means, oh, she's an idolater, that's bull. You know, she's a daughter of a different creation. She's not part of God's creation. She's not of God because she's not born of God. That's what that means. So there's no way Sheila's an Israelite.
Yeah, that's what I pretty much tried to debate on the phone a few years ago with Alan, and he says no. He said the reason why that she was an Israelite through Judah is because God applied the law when the other two boys got destroyed because one of them spilled, and so
he that doesn't make any sense though. So like, that's why I don't even bother reading Balakias, is because I don't need all this nonsense. Hey,
that's a presumption that God applied the law because of that act. And it's also a presumption that God was angry about the spill when he could have been angry if you read it about the entire act itself.
Right. That's a good point.
And that's what I've never heard anybody really say. Maybe Bill did, and I got it years ago and forgot, but I don't understand why that sticks in people's, you know, it's like a cog in the wheels.
even John the Baptist, Herod was a bastard. He was an Edomite, and he claimed to be a Judean, and he claimed to worship Yahweh. All the Herods did. But John the Baptist held him responsible based on a law. Why? Because Herod claimed to be following the law. So the law can be used to judge the enemies of God who claim to be following it when they're not.
It seems like to me, though, Bill, from what you just said, these Edomites in Judea, they strapped it around their own neck. They were very proud of saying they had the law, right?
According to the law, what son gets the double portion and the scepter and the family priesthood?
The firstborn, right?
Okay. So who did all the kings in Judah come from?
From Judah. The tribe of Judah, right? Supposedly.
What son?
Oh, let me think. I forget, Bill.
Through Phares?
To Phares and Zerah, that's right.
So why didn't they come from Shelah?
Now you got a point there. I remember that now.
Why didn't Shelah even fucking mention
as
having an inheritance?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I wish that Alan would come in these chats with us. It's not like he can't afford it. He knows how to use a laptop.
No,
he'll
never do it, Michael, because you know why? He has to lower himself to the level of just a regular guy. How about that?
Yeah, here we're all brothers and we study together, but he's got a title where I'm a pastor, I'm a teacher.
Well, that's probably why. On good terms with Eli, he wouldn't come here either. Because he couldn't be one of the crowd. He couldn't be one of the boys. He couldn't just talk as an equal among men. He couldn't do it. They need that pulpit to talk from. They'll only talk from a pulpit.
It's the same as MRJ. MRJ said to me, "You don't get to just come off the street and debate me." That's what he said. In reference to CR.
Yeah, everybody else. Fuck him. He's a faggot.
Hey, Joe, who's MIJ?
If you could take away his pulpit, what's he got then? He hasn't got any arguments that he can bring against us. He can't argue against CR. So you take away the pulpit, what's he got? Nothing. So he relies on, I'm a priest, and who are you to question me? That's what he does.
You know what? Michael. He doesn't even have a pulpit. He's not a priest. But the thing is, he's so arrogant and egotistic that he believes that he's so much smarter than everybody around him. But if you listen to his work or read his work, he always mentions that everybody is stupid in this society. So he's saying that I'm the smartest of the stupid group, right? So he's actually insulting himself.
Joe, who is MIJ? I may know it. Who is this?
Michael Raphael Johnson.
Oh, I remember him. Yeah.
He actually got kicked out of his own church. He's not even a priest anymore, as far as I know. I mean, he might have joined some other Orthodox group, but even they got rid of him. But, you know, he'll say.
Okay,
because...
we're starting to get off on a tangent.
We're pretty much done with the...
Come on, we're pretty much done with Daniel.
One chapter? Okay.
Martin, it's going to be a long chapter.
Yeah, like, take a look at it, right?
Daniel chapter 8 is going to be as long as tonight.
All right, I'll cut the recording.
Just trust me, I know the material.